Come on, let's go. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas capitals,
we are about to broadcast
this moment in our history.
Hello, and welcome to the History Workshop podcast. I'm Mary Beth Hamilton. A few years ago, a German radical historian named Albert Scharenberg noticed something intriguing. Young people were becoming far less likely to absorb information from reading books than from listening to podcasts. As part of the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, a progressive nonprofit devoted to civic education, democratic participation, and the empowerment of marginalized groups, he was looking for a way to connect with people in their late teens and 20s by exploring significant historical topics without sacrificing complexity or depth. The result was Rosa Lux History, a German language podcast that has covered a wide range of topics from German colonialism to the history of the squatters movement to the Spanish Civil War. Taking its credo from Walter Benjamin, it aims to brush history against the grain, replacing stories shaped by the victors with more nuanced and dynamic narratives from below that suggest strategic possibilities for social and political change. I sat down over Zoom with Albert Scharenberg to talk about the evolution of Rosa Lux History, the radical potential of the podcast medium, and the challenge of disseminating radical history in a political climate where history is too often simplified, falsified, dismissed, or ignored. I began by asking him to talk about what led him to create the podcast to start with.
Yeah, actually, the initial idea or the idea behind it started in 2019, a few months before the COVID crisis hit. And I wasn't initially looking into podcasts, but I was trying to figure out what to do now that, you know, how to convey political education with historical content, because all we know is that especially young people read less and less, and most times history is being told in books. So I realized that this is sort of becoming more difficult, at least if you want to target a younger audience. And then I found out at the same time that these young people, it's not that they are not interested in the topics, but that they use other means to so they listen to podcasts. I mean, a lot of podcasts. I found out at that time that more than one in four young Germans regularly listen to podcasts, and the numbers have risen ever since. So it seemed to be a good instrument. And also, I have a background in teaching, both at the university level and political education classes. And since I was working for the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, as I mentioned, I was looking for new avenues to convey historical content from a left perspective, in particular to young people. And this is how I came up with the idea of trying to do it in a podcast. In early 2020, I started working on a concept and then later included my colleague and co-host, Annika Taschke. So we are doing this more or less together. On the content side, I would say, and this is also up on our website, our motto is Walter Benjamin's suggestion to brush history against the grain. And this is sort of what we want to do, because honestly, who wants to retell what the rulers of the past wanted us to know about them? And that's often done in conventional history. And what we want to do in this podcast, that's part of the concept, we want to tell a different story, a little bit like your podcast, a history from below. And that's the main focus. And we want to do it with empathy to those who today, in the present, are dominated by the heirs of the ruling classes of the past. So it does have a connotation that I think Walter Benjamin would have liked, because our starting point is the present and not the past. And we want to put current issues in their proper historical context.
I want to ask you about your audience, but can I first ask you just about the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation and its remit and how that feeds into this and how it feeds into your work?
Yes, the Rosa. I'm obviously an employee of the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, and I've been in different capacities. Initially, I was a co-director setting up the office in New York City from 2012 to 2018. And since then, I've been working here at the headquarters in Berlin. I was first director of the historical department. And this is actually where I came up with the idea of a podcast. That's the background. And then the historic department, due to a rearrangement in the foundation, doesn't exist as an entity anymore. So I'm now working in a different capacity, but I continue doing the podcast. The foundation itself is what in German law would be called a political foundation, a foundation that's close to a party. All parties that are represented in federal parliament for, I think, two or three consecutive legislative periods are entitled to government funding for their own foundation. Now, technically, this is a separate entity. It's not a party foundation. We must not support, you know, party activities or campaigns or anything like that. But it's close to. There's the legal formulation here. So we, of course, are in close contact with a party. And this is the source of our funding. The stronger the party is in national parliament, the more funding we get. And the weaker it is, the less we get. So it's directly tied, basically, to the fate of the party, the left party itself. And it's a quite huge foundation. We have a few hundred employees in Germany. We have regional offices in the German states. And we have, I think, about 24 offices across the globe, one of them being New York City that I helped setting up back in 2012. And the purpose is civic or political education, depends on, I think in Britain you can say political education, in the US that you would rather say civic education. But that's the main purpose. So that's the context of where this podcast, I think, fits in.
And Rosa Luxemburg as a kind of guiding spirit. I mean, she is the namesake of the foundation because of her political legacy. I'd love to hear more.
Actually, all these foundations have sort of a famous person as the namesake, and ours is Rosa Luxemburg. I was a voluntary associate of the foundation back in the days. And there was a discussion about it, but we pretty soon settled on Rosa Luxemburg because there's so many reasons to it. First of all, she was really a brilliant thinker and writer. If you read her text, she's a fantastic writer, especially if you compare that to the party hacks usually that are, more narrow in focus, and also in language. She's great in language, even though she's not a native German speaker. She's a native from Poland. She was born and grew up in the Russian-occupied or annexed part of Poland. So that's also interesting. And she's Jewish. She grew up speaking Yiddish. So her background, you know, as a Polish woman who came to Germany, as a Jewish woman, as a socialist, and as a radical of lasting significance, as opposed to most other contemporaries, we thought she's just the right fit for us. Okay. And actually, we do one of our episodes is on Rosa Luxemburg also, of course, that was around her, the celebrations of her 150th birthday back in 2021.
I remember the comic book. I might cut this bit out, or maybe I'll leave it in. But the History Workshop Journal ran a wonderful review essay about Red Rosa when it came out. And I think I was in correspondence with Paul Buell around it. I can't remember because it was a while ago.
Exactly. But and I was actually instrumental in making that happen along with Paul, because I was, as mentioned, I was the co-director of the New York office, and Paul approached us with the idea of doing a comic, graphic novel on Rosa Luxemburg. And he needed support, and we were willing to support him ideally, but also a project that we would support financially. And then he somehow, through context, managed to dig up Kate Evans, the artist, and she was just amazing. I think Rosa Luxemburg was love at first sight for her, and she really dove into it. And we would communicate about it. I could help out with a few historic effects, but this is really her work. And most amazing, I think, it came out, and it's been a big success story. I mean, they have tens of thousands of copies have been sold by Verso Books, but it has also been translated in I don't even know how many languages. I think it's about 15 by now. It's because it's really well done. And she put a lot of research in it. And very amazingly, for a graphic novel, she actually does footnotes. And, you know, so to explain everything and why she chose what and so forth. And it also came out in Germany a few years ago. It was a big success here also. And as I said, you know, it came out in like 50 languages. It was translated into Hebrew, Polish, Russian, Ukrainian, and but also I think in Korean and Spanish, French, Portuguese. I think in Slovenia it came out also. Really an amazing book that she did. Mostly Kate did. I really can't emphasize enough what a great job she did.
But I think it's interesting in getting back to where we started with the conversation, which is the impetus that you had to try to think about how can the ideas of radical history reach young people in a form that they can take on board. I mean, graphic novels was one way, even if it came from Paul Buell, that you were feeding into, and the podcast being another. With the Rosa Lux podcast, your audience, what do you know about them, or what are they in your mind?
Well, first of all, we have a target audience, and our targeted audience is young people roughly between 16 and 29 years of age. And as far as we know, we actually reached this audience quite well. I think the reason is that we try to think about the podcasts and its topics from their perspective, from their standpoint and interests. So we try to take that as a starting point in order to actually be able to generate any interest in this demographic. And we know quite a bit about our primary audience. I mentioned already, you know, they're moving away from text, in particular long reads, to podcasts, and of course to social media, which is another story though. But many listen to podcasts and also to long podcasts, surprisingly. And this was an important link, as I pointed out earlier, that podcasts are a particularly good instrument for reaching the younger generation. When I say that we try to think about podcasts from their standpoint or interest, is also that we generally assume that our audience does not know anything about the respective topics. We don't try to water it down or to take it to a very basic level, but we make sure that we explain everything and don't assume anything in terms of knowledge, which I think is very important for podcasts generally, as opposed to text, where you can narrow things down a little bit more. But for us, this is also quite important for the design of the episodes. If you don't assume any knowledge, you have to explain everything. Also, we really try to avoid any unnecessary name dropping or science jargon, because that's turning people off, and it's oftentimes used to show off, you know, how knowledgeable you are and what a great person you are, that you know these people and that you are familiar with the science jargon. We do use some terms, but we always make sure to explain them. One other thing that for us was important, we always choose really broad topics. When we did the research, we found out that most history podcasts focus on rather specific topics. But we wanted to try a different approach in terms of reaching a younger generation that wants more, you know, broader knowledge, maybe more also wants to be introduced in broader topics. And we like to think that our podcast provides the educational groundwork by giving our audience some tools for digging deeper themselves, basically. And then there's a bunch of other things in order to reach the younger generation, the targeted audience. We created an Instagram account, which is rosalux_history. Doesn't have the same reach at the postcard, but it surely helps reaching young people who, as you know, are on Instagram more than they are on Facebook or even Twitter. Okay, last thing maybe is that we know that our audience is not limited to young people or to our targeted audience. There's actually a broad range of listeners, including many academics, which we know because we do get feedback, oftentimes in person, actually. Yeah, and that, of course, is very valuable, any kind of feedback, as you know, probably yourself, because you're doing your podcast also. It informs you on what you can make better. And we're actually planning to soon do a survey, to conduct a survey also with our listeners to find out a little bit more.
I've got so many questions. Is there signaling, apart from the fact that it's called Rosalux History, which maybe somewhat gives the political slant away, but do you assume that your audience shares a particular political value system? Because you say you assume that they know nothing. Presumably, have they covered any of the topics that you cover in school? And is your sense of offering a counter narrative or a corrective narrative or a different vantage point driven by political commitments?
Yeah, I think it's both. We don't assume that they hold the same views as we do. And we try to do the podcast, even though it's a left and a quite at times radical podcast, we try to not limit ourselves to any particular view. There have to be more than one for a number of reasons. But again, as I said, we don't assume any particular view, and that would also narrow the audience pretty much. And we are doing political education. So we don't want to sell any party line or whatever. That's of no interest at all to us. We want to convey a certain approach to history, a rather critical approach, a left approach. And well, if I want to make it big, I would say to make it popular, you know, to approach history in another way than it's usually done in school. It's not that all of these topics that we do are not at all covered in school. That goes back to your question. We do want a certain counter narrative at times. For instance, the reasons for the rise and victory of the German Nazis. There's a certain narrative in the German public that will tell you, you know, it was the radicals from the right and left who were responsible for it, which, pardon me for the language, but no, I'm not saying it. It's bullshit. Mm-hmm. It's not true. And anybody who digs deeper will find out that it was the middle classes who are responsible for the rise and success of the Hitler party. So in one episode, we take that and explain or from our point of view what the facts behind this are and why it is rather, I think it was Seymour Lipset who called it the radicalism of the center that led to the victory of fascism and the whole narrative that the unemployed and downtrodden were responsible. It doesn't meet the facts at all. They would vote for the communists or for the social democrats by a vast majority. Of course, there were also ones that voted for the NSDAP, but the narrative is simply soaked in ideology, the mainstream narrative. And we sort of try to get the facts straight and use various sources, not just from the left, but also some of the rather, you know, politically mainstream or center scholars know that also. And you can quote them. And yeah, so it's both. It's to try to convey a certain perspective on history and historical issues, but also to provide a counter narrative to things that are being taught from a mainstream perspective in school. Not that they're all bad, but that there, let's say there are issues with it.
Right, right. And do you counter it through, is it, what am I trying to say? Do you interview people who then provide different sorts of input, historians or archivists or whatever, or are you telling a narrative, taking the listener through the events?
Yeah, the interviews are very important. We can come back to that in a minute, but we try to do that on our own. So there's a script. It's a scripted podcast. The interviews obviously are not scripted, but the narrative is scripted and it takes up about half the time. So the basic interpretation is what we provide. And this is also always painful. I do most of the research, and if I have the script, then it's always too long. And then you have to cut out stuff. And the first round is okay, but then literally every sentence you lose information, because how much is it? 12, 14 pages maybe that you have to cover a whole topic, like say the Russian Revolution. And that's not a lot, because you need to start, you know, with what led to the revolution. And that's our main threat, basically. And then we have interviews with three people, usually scholars, sometimes also activists. And we ask them on a specific topic within this broader framework that we want to give some more space to in the context of the podcast. This is a little bit difficult also, because there are always more than three things that you want to talk about in a little more depth. But yeah, that's part of it. And also, just to round that up, is so it's the narrative that takes up about half the time. Then we have three interviews that take out like 6 to 8 minutes each. And then we have one or two cultural contributions that we call it. So we have a professional reading of a poem, of an historical source, of a short text, or something like that. So just to break it up a little bit. And that's basically the three main components of the podcast.
And how do you choose the topics? Do you have a sort of master list that you're working your way through? Or is it suggested by what's happening in the present moment on the political scene around you?
No, actually, it is influenced by what's going on, or by, let's say, the Rosa Luxemburg we did on the occasion of her 150th birthday, because that, you know, that's out there and will generate interest. So we do use that. Or now with the upcoming 50th anniversary of the Coronation Revolution, the next episode will deal with Portuguese history. So yeah, that is important, but only if there's an opportunity that we can jump on. So there are other topics that we think we should do or are relevant to the left in general that we pick up as well. Generally, as I mentioned, we focus on broad topics as we assume that they would generate the most interest, especially in the young generation. And also because it's a little bit distinct from most of the other history podcasts, which focus on on comparatively narrow topics. And then also, yeah, we do choose topics that are relevant, let's say, for an anniversary or other reasons. But we also care, as you brought up, about contemporary left politics. And this is also important for choosing at least certain topics. And if you look at the episodes 26 so far that we have done, they basically all cover really broad or big topics. Just to give a few ones, it's colonialism, the labor movement, the Russian Revolution, the German Revolution, the Paris Commune, Spanish Civil War, Communist International, or social movement like the squatters or the women's liberation movement. Those are important. And we also do quite a bit on what commonly is referred to as diversity. You know, we do Black history, Black German history, Jewish history, the historic self-organization of the Gastarbeiter migrants from the 60s. And we've done, I think by now, 5 biopics of, you know, important representatives of the German and European left. One thing that is also interesting, I think, is, or important for me at least, I have tried and done, I've fend off topics that some topics, because I think it's we do include some global topics and movements, anti-colonialism, for instance, and cover them in an episode. But the podcast really focuses on European history from a left perspective. German and European history from a left perspective. And that's why, for instance, I didn't want to do one on the Chilean coup d'etat in 73 or other topics. They are also great to do, and I think they should be done. But I really like to focus on rather on Germany and Europe, not only because I know more about Germany and Europe, but also it gives it a little bit more of a specific taste, and not we do anything where there's a movement, we jump on it and just do it.
Well, one thing I was struck by in reading some of the materials you flagged for me was this sense of responding to the imminent catastrophes brewing at this moment, you know, globally, obviously, with the rise of the far right everywhere, but particularly in Europe. And I wondered, how much are you conscious of a need to address a sort of either historical amnesia or disinformation or just a lack of engagement with or sense that history is even relevant to understanding where we are? I mean, this is kind of endemic in the UK and in the United States, certainly, this sense that, you know, that all stuff happened back in the days of the dinosaurs and we don't need to concern ourselves with that.
Yes, actually, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's actually part of the background why we do this in the first place. When I in the beginning brought up, you know, the need to convey historical knowledge or content to a younger generation, this, of course, is part of the background. And there seems to be a kind of amnesia, but also I think it's a generational issue, you know, and it's being talked about also in terms of historical fascism, that when I was born, fascism had been over for 20 years only. You know, that was really close. My parents were little kids in 1945, but they did experience it, and my grandparents way more, you know. So it was always around, everywhere, basically. There were still old Nazis. I mean, from back in the days, now you have new Nazis. But that's very different from people born like in the 2000s, because that's ancient history to them. And even the student movement of the 60s is ancient history to them, and they don't necessarily see why it affects them. Of course, with a history podcast, you can't really convince those who think it's not important, because they won't listen anyway. But you can reach those who think, well, that might be worth checking out or give it a try. And that's the opening that we try to use. And then, of course, you know, work is exactly like you outlined, you know, and trying to fill this void that's out there, and to, you know, make sense out of this mess that we are living through these days, with the rise of fascism, not just in Germany, but across Europe, the Western world, and actually the whole world. Yeah, and then the amnesia that people, you know, don't think it has anything to do with history, which of course is totally wrong.
This is all so wonderful. And I'm trying to think of final questions I'd have, because you covered so much that I wanted to ask you. But I guess if you have any further thoughts about the potential of podcasts for radical historians, you know, why they should do it if they're not already thinking of putting their work in that format, what can podcasts do maybe better than a book or an article, or podcasts that you particularly recommend to people who haven't heard them, whether they're German speakers or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I already answered the first half of the question, why I think that podcasts are a great means of bringing across some knowledge about history, historical topics, and also controversies. But we start, as I mentioned, from the present, and we always look at the past from the present. And that's, I think, the approach that is very important, because why would you do history if it's not relevant for today? I mean, I'm a nerd, obviously, so I like Roman history and other stuff also, which does have to do with the presence, but, you know, remotely so. But that's an approach for a nerdy podcast. There are nerdy podcasts around there, and I occasionally listen to to one of them. But if you want to reach a broader audience, in particular younger people, that's not the way of doing it. But if people want to do a podcast themselves, I think generally in terms of what the potential is, I would say this basically the sky is the limit. Podcast is still a pretty new, format or way of presentation. It's basically radio in a can, if you want. But we are at the beginning of the podcast area. So there's a lot of potential, both in terms of type and size of audience and with respect to how we approach and present topics. There's a lot to explore. And I do a specific podcast. I can talk about, you know, what works for us and or why it has worked for us. But there's like probably a million other ways of doing it out there that need to be tested. You know, others do very specific topics, do it in 15 minutes and, you know, let's see how that works. I don't want to let listeners off the hook after 15 minutes. once I get them, you know, I think there's more that can be done. But what I would, if I have one recommendation for people who want to do podcasts, I think it is really crucial to think about it from the perspective of your target audience. First, think who you want to do the podcast for, because then you can think, you know, how you want to do it. And before that, if you don't do that, that's fine. You know, you can still do that. If you want to just say what you want to say, that's fine. But that's a nerdy approach. Again, there's an audience for that, but that's, I think, rather limited. And in order for you to be successful, start with the target audience and then always start. If you do an episode, always put you in the mind or ask people of your target audience, or at least put you in the mind of your target audience and think, you know, what do they want to learn? What do they want to hear about? I think, why do they want a podcast on this in the first place? I think that's very helpful. At least it was for us, in terms of the design of the podcast and also then later how you advertise it with the means that you have, how you actually try to reach the audience that you want to target. In terms of listening to podcasts, I do listen to podcasts, but not to that many as some people might assume, because I do a podcast myself. But there are a few ones that are out there. I don't want to go into details because there are so many, and probably there are people who can better evaluation of them. But there's, if you think of radical podcasts, for instance, there is the Working Class History podcast that's published in English. I think that's worth checking out. They have, I think, more than 80 episodes up now. Some are double, so that sometimes they need two episodes to tell one story. Which we don't allow ourselves because of the young target audience. But I think that's worth checking out. In Germany, I'm not so sure. There's one of the nerdy podcasts that I like. It's Fabian Lehr, L-E-H-R. He doesn't do anything of what we do. He just reads his texts. But they're good. They're really good. And they are definitely from a left critical perspective and an undogmatic perspective, which for me is always, I mean, that's the first thing that you look at. If they want to sell you anything in terms of their politics, I'm out in a second, because that's boring and that's ideology production, basically. But if they are more open, that's worth it. And that's one thing that, before we come to an end, I want to bring up is very important to us. We don't want to narrow this down. We want to do political or civic education. We want to broaden people's perspective. So we don't want to just put out one perspective. We want to include various perspectives. And that's also why we want to have various perspectives in the podcast. It's not that we only ask, you know, radical academics to be guests at our podcast. We also asked activists to have another approach. But we also, you know, ask people who are not decidedly left, you know, who hold more conventional views or are more liberal in an American understanding of the term. And that's, I think, really helpful because they have a lot to say also. And who am I that, you know, would know anything better than they do? And I really like including different perspectives and also doing the narrative in a way that we bring up different interpretations at times. And I've done that always. I'm a professional historian, but I have a background in university teaching, but also a very long background in political education. And one very standard and basic rule is, if anything is controversial in society, you have to present it as a controversial topic. Now, you don't have to say, I don't care about which interpretation. That's not believable in a podcast. You have to be authentic anyway. You have to put out your viewpoint also. But that doesn't mean you have to answer any questions. Sometimes we say, okay, these are various interpretations. Figure it out yourself. Which one is the most important or which one you agree with or not. We don't do that always. But this kind of stuff that you don't pretend that there's only one correct answer to what was going on in history, but that there are various perspectives on it. And I think that's also the direction in which academic history has moved in more and more, because we know what's has been left out, you know, in the traditional narratives of history, which was a male perspective, which was a white perspective, it was a European perspective, it was a well-off perspective, and all this stuff. There are various perspectives that are very important to include. And now, while you may claim, some people claim, oh, this is necessarily a left perspective, if it is a women's perspective or a black perspective, that's not true either. And so you have to, I think, just make it vivid and make sure that the listeners to a podcast, the audience, that they understand, okay, we bring facts and we try to bring a narrative and put them together. And much of it is basic, but maybe other people would bring up other stuff. And there's controversy around these issues. I think we do pretty good introductions in terms of that you do get an overview on the respective topics and also, you know, some help with interpreting it. But I'm not sure if we really managed to do that, but you have to stay humble. You really have to stay humble, especially because it's so those are so broad topics. And there are people out there who know more about each of these topics than I do. I mean, they do research and they are professors and they have worked like 30 years on, I don't know, the Russian Revolution or so. And now here's me coming, you know, doing a narrative for young people. That is specific. But it is important also to have to really look into what's going on in the academic field and also the more recent trends. I always do that when I start researching. What's the new books out there? What's the current debate on this issue? What are the maybe the edges or what is interesting? And that's also what that leads to certain potential guests, but also it informs the narrative. For example, when we did this thing on the rise of fascism, we also did include the contemporary debate that was out in Germany about the Hohenzollern, the prince who was wanted, you know, a lot of his stuff back, let's put it that way. And we decided, well, that's interesting. And we want to include that. And so we found an academic who has been working on that intensely, and we would have a discussion with her about this aspect and how it is important in contemporary Germany and is, you know, very closely linked to how you interpret the past. That's the basic. I mean, you know that you can interpret in various ways, but understanding the fact that it can be interpreted in various ways, that's lesson number one.
Many thanks to Albert Scharenberg for taking part in this conversation. You can read more about him and about Rosa Luxe history on the episode page for this podcast. Please visit our website, historyworkshop.org.uk. You can find us on X at HistoryWO and on Facebook and Instagram as History Workshop. This is the History Workshop podcast. I'm Mary Beth Hamilton. Thanks for listening.